H.R. Wallingford. He's going to talk about general engineering usage and areas for improved research.
Right. Okay. Just a little bit of background about what H.R. Wallingford is. We used to be a government, we were set up as a government research station just after the war, but we've been privatised in 1982. So we do basically consultancy work predicting waves for industry, basically. So now we've got a large modelling hall. You can see down on the bottom left there. And we work, the company works basically with anything to do with water. So we do modelling of anything to do with water. Freshwater, flooding, coastal, which a lot of the wave energy, what wave work comes into, maritime works, and energy, which includes, we don't do so much of the deep offshore work, we do more of the nearshore facilities. So there's a oil and gas import facilities. We're a non-profit distributing company, so all our profits get reinvested back into the company and into research. So we still do quite a lot of our own funded research and development, and 250 staff. We work, our projects cover, when we were set up as a government research station, we did mainly UK work, but now our work is worldwide. And this is about maybe in some of the sort of things we do. This is maybe for port design, wave disturbance modelling of harbours on the left there. This doesn't work. Design conditions. Designing approach channels for ports. The waves are very important for that. They're affecting the vessels. They affect the underkeel clearance that you need for the design. Breakwaters. We do physical modelling of stability of breakwaters, and coastal impact studies. So. Quite a wide range of studies, and that's just really in the sort of maritime coastal area. So in terms of engineering, engineering studies, what do the coastal engineers want from us, and why do we need to predict the waves? So stability of armour units on a breakwaters or sea walls. That's physical modelling shot there. Overtopping of sea defences is obviously important for flooding. That's the on the Dawlish line, which was where the rail line was destroyed fairly recently. And then impact on the coast in terms of beach movement, scour. Coastal protection is a big issue in a lot of parts of the world. So there's a lot of applications for wave modelling. And then in terms of renewables, the UK is quite big in offshore wind farms at the moment, quite a long way ahead obviously of the wave power industry, and they need wave climates in terms of for construction planning, maintenance, fatigue assessment of the turbines. In fact, that the fatigue on the turbine is on the turbine pile is the limiting factor in terms of determining the steel thickness. It's not the severe design wave. It's actually the fatigue load which tends to be the critical factor. They obviously also need extreme design conditions, HS, HMAX, lots of different measures of period as Lloyd was saying, as Ken was saying. Joint probabilities of waves and water levels are important in terms of setting crest elevations of anything. And then once you've been looking at historical waves, you can use the same sort of models to consider forecasting ways for construction purposes and maintenance. Right, so waves obviously parameterized. Some of this sort of stuff has been mentioned before. A scatter diagram showing wave climate, so that's wave height, a significant wave height against mean direction. These are the sorts of things which the designers might want. So they're very interested in, obviously need to know about random waves. We're not interested in regular waves, really. It's all random wave sea states that in reality. So that's just the sort of outputs that an engineer might want. So the starting point in most of these studies is to look at the general background ocean waves, and there's many models which are run operationally from people like the Met Office, NOAA in the States, and ECMWF in Reading. So most of these models are run as forecast models, but they've also been run as hindcasts to give the long-term climate. And you can get probably about 30 years from most of these. This NOAA CFSR hindcast is just a recent one, which has been 30 years globally. Met Office has got a range of models. More resolution around the UK. So most of these ocean models have converged on using WaveWatch 3 model. And they're all validated against satellite data and buoys. So at HL Wallingford we don't do this wider scale ocean modelling. We pick up on the results from these long-term hindcasts. Use those as the boundary conditions. So the key problem really in the nearshore zone is the influence of the bathymetry, and this is just showing some model bathymetry, real bathymetry in the Wash area on the east coast of the UK. So they've got the Humber estuary up here, and then the Wash down here. And that the left-hand slide is a zoom in of part of that area, showing two areas where there are going to be some offshore wind farms. And you can see there's a wide, these long sandbanks. The blue areas are deep, and the sort of reds and yellows are shallow. So there's huge differences in depth. And there'll be quite an influence of the bathymetry on the wave conditions. So you'll have a variation in conditions across the areas due to the influence of the sandbanks. And so this is the sort of modelling that we would do for clients. And it's important to cover quite a wide area. And you can see the sort of processes. You need to look at quite a lot. This is somewhere different, but look at a wide spatial area, consider the shallow water processes, transform in complete wave spectra, not just look at individual waves or regular waves, and run for a large number of sea states to build up the complete climate. So it's quite a big task, and there's always this balance between the complexity of the model and the amount of modelling you can do. People are wanting to build up a wave climate. You need, over a large area, you need a relatively simple model in most cases. So the sort of bread and butter modelling that we might do would be using something like the SWAN model, which is an open source model quite widely used by ourselves and other consultants. So it's a spectral representation of the wave action balance equation. It covers most of the processes we're interested in, but it's all, you're averaging the wave, so you're not resolving the wavelengths. So you're only going to get out quantities like significant wave height, and well, you can get out the wave spectrum at any of the points. But this shows some model results with the colours showing the significant wave height going from reds, which are high, to blues, which are low, and some of the lines are the, some of the offshore banks. In it's not exactly the same area as before, but it's a similar area. You can see, you know, quite a spatially varying wave fields, which are important to sighting of these offshore wind farms and producing the design conditions. And then another level of detail closer into maybe a port, you might want to look at phase resolving models. So this is a elliptic Mars slope equation model. We can use Boussinesq models. You need to consider partial reflections inside harbours from armoured structures or quay walls, wave diffraction and interference, and harbour resonance. And long waves are also very important for harbours because you might get resonance at long wave periods. So I'm talking about infragravity waves. Also, vessels can surge on the berths, and the long there's not much you can do about the long wave getting into the harbour. So it's quite often in some of especially on some sort of swell affected coasts, somewhere like South Africa, a lot of their ports have great problems with long waves, and it's very difficult to mitigate against that. You can do maybe adjusting the moorings of the vessel, but that's also another issue that's quite important. We do modelling of moored vessels, but one thing that is worth doing is and some people have done it, is put the vessels into something like a Boussinesq model, and then move the vessel with the waves. But you've got to include all the effects of the mooring lines and the fenders, so it gets a bit more complicated. So we still do physical modelling. We do a lot of physical modelling still. And so at the top we've got one of the wave paddles, that's a multi-element wave paddle. We make these and supply them to other laboratories and universities, and so that produces full directional spectrum, if you like. Rock armor structures, and then the other type of modeling that's quite a lot of is vessel movement. So these vessels have got moored up against quays, and they'll have the mooring line forces and the forces on the fenders, and we'll run waves at those sort of vessels. So why do we still use physical models? Certain things are more difficult to do, obviously, in the numerical models. Stability of breakwaters, you've got these interlocking armour units in the top left. If you to model that in full detail, it's you've got to go to a lot of detail to model the fluid flows within those units. And I'll show you later on the sort of modelling we've been doing numerically, but I'm just saying we still do a lot of physical modelling of that sort of thing. Overtopping again is quite tricky in the numerical model. You have to look at in fine detail at that. Scour and the vessel motion. So they're the main things that we still use physical models for. So one of those is the moored vessel response. I've mentioned the mooring line forces and fender forces have to be accurately scaled. you have to run directional random waves, otherwise the motions of the vessel can be completely different. You've got to consider long waves, wind and current forces as well. The top diagram shows, you can see there's four cameras there, and we can model we can represent in the physical model the motion of the vessel. We can track that by little reflective spheres over the vessel filmed from these four positions, and you can analyze that to get the full motion, all the degrees of freedom. Oops, wrong way. Okay, so this is on the sort of armor stability type tests. This is just a small flume, looking at stability and overtopping. Again, it's a random wave test, and as Ken was saying before, you're putting in a certain spectrum here, but the groupiness of the waves is very important. So you'll see that, watching this for a little bit of time, you can see that it's the random nature of the sea means that you've got to run it for quite a long time to get a representative conditions. We'd run these for thousands of waves, not just a few waves. So when you're talking about numerical modelling of these things, and you're talking about CFD and SPH, and you're running 10 waves or something like this, you've got to be careful because, as you can see, you've got to set up the groupiness of the waves is very different. I mean, you get calm periods, and immediately you get a large wave like that. So it's quite interesting to see something a bit, see how much variability there is and that's just from, you know, within a certain sea state. We're not varying the sea state there. So we're still building physical models even. This is one we've just built, just going to be commissioning. It's for wave current interaction, so we can get strong currents through there. We can put the waves over the top of it. And just in the middle there, there's a deeper hole, and you can fill that with sediment, and it's for looking at things like scour around wind turbines, but also for more research into wave current interaction.
Which current speed can you
use? We can get, I've not said that on here. I think it's 2 meters a second, but I can check on that. So, wave forces on structures, you've got to look at the non-linearity of the waves, obviously, wave pressures, wave crest elevations. So you can use Bruce and S models in a deeper water. And here, this is just a picture of the sort of thing where, obviously, they've not looked at this is Hurricane Katrina, and the crest elevation of the bridges in a lagoon, which doesn't normally get very large waves. But under Hurricane Katrina, there were some larger waves, and the wave crests obviously were impacting on the underside of the decks, so it caused a bit of a mess. Didn't realise there was sound on that. I'll turn the sound off. Without the sound. So once you get in the surf zone, Bruce and S model, Bruce and S models have been running the surf zone, but you have to parameterize the get that going again. Bruce and S models, they can be run in the surf zone, but you have to parameterize the wave breaking. So one way has been looked at is to link a Bruceness model with, once you get close to inshore, to link it to a nonlinear shallow water equation model. And that models the breaking through the shockwave theory. So that can be another way of modeling these sort of things. This is just show this picture because it's this video, because you can see it's a very long wave, it's quite a long period swell. It's off the coast of Chile, this one, and the people who designed this jetty, I don't think were expecting as much shoaling up of the waves, and it just shows how it's very important not to to get the wave crest elevations correct. They had to completely rebuild this jetty in the end. So, getting into this more detailed sort of modelling, this is using CFD modelling, open foam, and so here you're solving the Navier-Stokes, full Navier-Stokes equations, and you've got a air-water interface, and it's obviously reasonably computationally expensive to do this sort of thing. We're only running a few waves here, but it's we've compared this with I might explain what it is first. It's a caisson breakwater. So this is a solid concrete caisson. It's sitting on a rubble mound on the seabed, and we're just running waves in, looking at the wave pressures at the top there, and obviously there's free surface and the overtopping of this caisson. So this might and the forces on the wall, the forces on both walls. So you can look and see if there's any overturning moments of this caisson. So this caisson was for a harbour breakwater, and they're obviously interested under severe conditions like this about how much overtopping you'd get. There's a berth on the other side, I think, and whether the caisson would slide on the bed or overturn in some way. So it's quite successful modelling it with CFD, but you can only model a few waves. It's just a couple of stills comparing the same thing against a slightly different setup, but the same model against a physical model. You can see this is a more impulsive wave overtopping. And some less severe overtopping sequence down there, so it's quite a useful tool. But it's computationally expensive still. This is an interesting one, Costa Concordia. You might have seen in the news that ran aground. It's a cruise vessel that ran aground in Italy, and they, as part of the salvage, they righted it onto a cradle, and then ready to repair it and then refloat it. And they were worried about the forces on the vessel when it was in this sort of righted state, if they got some reasonable wave conditions. So this was just a simulation we did, again with the open foam model. We're running some swell waves at it, and looking at, on the right here, you can see the pressure on the sides of the vessel, both sides of the vessel. So you can see, you can see what forces are involved and whether it's going to break its moorings. But lucky it didn't. They didn't have very severe conditions when they actually floated it. But this was, I think, a 1 in 10 year condition we were trying to simulate here, and we thought it should still be able to survive that. So why don't we use CFD modelling all the time? Because it's computationally expensive. You can only really run for a short profile, or over a small area, and for a few individual waves. So, as I say, in a physical model, if we're running a single test condition, we might run a sea state, maybe a 1 in 100 year event, for 2,000 or more waves. But that's quite quite challenging in the CFD modelling. It's quite a lot of computing to do that. And then you've got the SPH modelling, which has been mentioned earlier. So the representing individual particles, that will naturally handle the free surface and the wetting and drying processes, but it's even more computationally expensive. So again, you know, we do some modelling with that, but there's this gap between the what you want to model in the real world and what you can realistically model in a reasonable length of time with more complicated models. So something, going to just talk a little bit about something that a colleague of mine, David Kelly, has been working on. This is full particle in cell model. So it's a sort of hybrid of the SPH modelling, particle-based modelling, and grid-based modelling. So you and there's a couple of references there. So you're tracking the particles, but then you're accumulating things over and solving over a grid. So it's more it has advantages, which I'll go into in a minute. So basic idea of it, you do a bit of you track some particles with SPH type modelling. And transfer those particle velocities onto a grid, and then on the grid you add all the body forces, diffuse the velocities, you solve the Poisson equations subject to the boundary conditions, and then project the velocity field onto the divergence free field. This is for an incompressible flow. And then you get a difference in the velocities, which you can transfer then from the grid to back onto the particles. So you do a correction to the particle velocities, and then you go back and you track the particles again through a sort of background field of velocities. So it's a sort of you're jumping between the particles and the cells, and this is much more efficient than SPH type modelling. This isn't really waves, this bomb, but although it's forming waves. This is just a steady flow, viscous flow around a cylinder. So there's a fixed cylinder there. And what we're looking at in this one actually is the mixing that you get. So I've just the water is just coloured in with depth, and you can see how you get the mixing bullet past the cylinder. But you can see what happens to the free surface there as well, and how you get the turbulence and the wave formed downstream of the cylinder.
It's a very efficient way of mixing the water up. Is that the intention?
It's very fast flow. Yes, I don't know the point of this actually, but I think it's just an example condition that we had some model results for physical model results to compare against. Yeah, that's right. Yes, you could. Yeah.
Yeah. Is this a commercial code, or is it homemade, or is it?
It's something that's being researched. We've got. As I say, Dave Kelly works for us, and he's developing it in conjunction with some people at Nottingham University as well. The method is not going to be, you know, secret. He's going to be publishing everything. As I say, there are some. Well, I'll go back to the references. So there's this one in the bottom one is in Coastal Engineering, and the next, the top one is hopefully coming out very soon, General Scientific Computing. But it's the sort of thing that we're quite keen on developing further, and And that's why we've got these links with Nottingham University to do that. So some other things. You can put solids in it as well. So a very simple test case that you knocked out very quickly, actually. This is, so he's got a tank with some waves in it. It's just a wave sloshing back and forth in a tank. And dropped a buoyant sphere into it. And I think he's got a little bit of a problem of some of the particles sticking to the sphere at the top. But, it's the way he handles solid bodies is that he solves the equations everywhere, but nobody solves equations everywhere, pretending the solid doesn't exist. So you've got particles within the solid as well. But then you have to account for the relative density. So the solid has a different density than the fluid, and then you have a way of enforcing the rigidity of the body, and you average basically all the particles within the body. Their velocities are averaged to get the velocity of the body when you go back into the grid. So. Yeah, it's enough of that. and just some of the other things he's modelled with it. This is some rock cuttings in a fluid. So the white blobs are just chips of rock falling down in a column of fluid, and it's part of an experiment that was. It was replicating a physical model experiment, but the sort of thinking behind it is for modelling something like a process inside a cutter suction dredger, where you're cutting rock or with a dredger. It breaks it up into little chips and then sucks it up a dredge pipe, and they get problems with knowing the sort of the throughput that they can get. Because of the turbulence inside, so actually this is quite interesting in the sense that as the rock particles fall down, because they're taking up quite a large proportion of the volume, they create a lot of turbulence within the water, and part of that sort of lifts the particles up, so you're slowing them down quite a bit, you know. So the turbulence is actually sort of you're reducing the rate you can get these particles down, even just through gravity. This was just done as a demonstration of how you can represent the bodies within the liquid. So just a sort of summary. Slide. I just wanted to say that there's this big gap. The main thing I was really trying to say in this talk was there's a big gap between parameterized models that are used every day in industry and the detailed models, which are maybe more used in academia and only just coming into use in industry, but they need to be more efficient in some way to be usable on a large modelling large areas and large numbers of waves, and so it'd be useful to have a more efficient surface zone model, wave structure interaction, and then moored vessel response. Again, something which is still quite a big, quite a complicated task. Long waves. A couple of other ideas. Extreme waves, I know, is going to be talked about later. When you're extrapolating, it's very important for design, you're extrapolating to a 100-year wave or a 1,000-year wave, and you've only got a certain amount of data. And actually, is the wave climate stationary anyway? You know, when we're looking at sea levels, we're always applying an allowance for sea level rise in our predictions of future sea level. Most extreme waves are based on extrapolation of the existing wave climate over measurements of the last 20, 30 years. But you know, is that climate actually stationary anyway? Is there increased storminess? And then something that's maybe this last winter's maybe highlighted a bit more, clustering and cumulative response of storms. Conditions, structures in the coastal zone and beaches and beach protection schemes are designed for extreme waves, certain return periods. Often what does the damage is not just the 100-year wave hitting it. This last winter, there was a lot of coastal damage, and none of the storms were more than about a 10-year return period. But we had five or six of them, all very close together, and the beaches in front of the seawalls never had a chance to recover. Structures were partially damaged. You know, a rock structure can suffer a little bit of damage and then can be repaired, but if you haven't got a chance to repair it and another storm hits it, it can go. So I think there'd be some interesting research to be done in terms of, or useful research to be done anyway, in terms of the clustering of storms. I think that's me finished, yeah. That's, as I say, that was the Dawlish sea wall, or near the Dawlish sea wall, which is one of the things that got into the news recently when damaged in the latest storms. Okay, yeah. Questions?
We have a coffee break coming up, but yeah. Perhaps we have a few questions first.
Yeah.
I would like to ask you about the irregular sea state from the CFD. And yeah. One of the things that you say is that this is so expensive because you need several thousand wave events to pick up what's actually going to happen.
Uh-huh.
Well, even today, when you're calculating loads for ships in the hydrodynamics, what they will do is they will pick something called design wave, whack a ship with a design wave and get the load from that.
Yeah.
So surely you must have some sort of shortcuts to pick up the interesting wave events rather than running CFD on thousands and thousands of irrelevant waves.
Yes. There are, but you would like to represent the whole random sea state rather than an individual wave. Ken was saying, you can take a wave spectrum, which might be the spectrum for your 100-year wave condition, and you can get quite different realizations of that same spectrum, depending on how the different waves are interacting. So. You'd really, as I say, if we're testing a sea wall for overtopping or structural stability, you will run a large number of waves because of this groupiness of the waves. You get one wave coming in, another wave following it, and you get a lot more overtopping.
Why not do something like a Swensee approach, where you'll be running these sea states using potential codes, and then picking up a window where you think something interesting is happening and running full CFD just there? Because in most of these small waves, etc.,
yeah.
The fact that you're running CFD is a waste of time.
Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah. But yes, I'm not saying you do want to replicate exactly the same process. What I'm saying is that if you're making it more realistic than the sort of regular wave type approach that most people have been doing in CFD, you really want to have fully random waves, directional spreading, and if you're looking, for example, at a moored vessel, it's very dependent on the directional spreading as well, and the groupiness of the waves, whether there's a long wave underneath that, the general wave. So there's quite a lot of combinations in a way that need looking at.
Okay, well, I think then we'll move into the coffee break. Thank you,
Nigel. Okay.